And there were 800 people sitting there. It's a hell of a big college.
Large briefing.
And I started off, well, it went very well. They were probably terribly confused. I could explain in great detail and with some sense the integration processes, but I was still groping around trying to find out what the bloody hell was meant by unification.
Mm-hmm.
And that confused me quite a bit. But the lighter side of this, I don't suppose you remember this, but the Associate Minister of Defense at that time had got himself involved with a German person called Gilda Munsinger.
Oh, I do, yeah.
Remember that?
Mm-hmm.
So I was able to bring that in. I produced some cartoons that I included in the things I was throwing on the screen. That lightened the thing a little bit. But afterwards, we spent the whole of that day at Fort Leavenworth, and I was showing around the place. They have the military prison there,
mm-hmm.
For all the bad guys and all the American soldiers. And the general with great pride said, "Admiral, we can carry out executions here any way the courts say. We can hang people, we can electrocute them, we can gas them, and he said we can shoot them with a firing squad. Would you like to do a tour of the prison?" I said, "Thank you, General, no." Anyway, well, then, a year after, in other words, the 1st of August, 1965, General Monsell went to the Vice Chief, and he was succeeded by Lieutenant General Frank Fleury, whom I'd known before, and an old friend, so everything brightened up considerably. Earlier that year, Admiral Landymore, who was a very popular flag officer at Atlantic Coast, he had taken up this opposition to unification, and he had tremendous support from his command. I had been sent down there by Monsell in the wintertime with a team of mixture of Air Force and Army people. And our job was to set up what is now known as Maritime Command.
Mm-hmm.
And Admiral Landymore didn't think anything of it. He wasn't at all taken with the whole idea. It was a very difficult. I think we spent a week down there. And I had to stay in the Admiral's house. I had, as his guest, I had gone down with General Rothschild, who was chief of, another old friend. He was the chief of material command, and he had his own aircraft, an old Goonie Bird.
For his own purposes?
Well, I mean, it was an Air Force plane, but this is the way he got around as a chief.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it would be a hell of a good idea if we went down with him, but in his aircraft, it would be better than going anywhere. And he wanted to visit the logistic facilities in the Halifax area. So he agreed. And I said, "Bob, we've got to stay in a hotel so that we'll be absolutely," I said, "in my case, I've got to be absolutely free of any sort of pressures or anything from people." "Oh, yeah, that's a good idea." So we made our reservations. And my golly, I was at home the night before we left, and Mrs. Landymore phoned and insisted that I stayed with them, and she did the same for Rothschild. Now, Rothschild wasn't part of this Maritime Command organization team.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we had no option. We were met at Shearwater Air Base by the Admiral, and we drove into his house in Halifax. And all the way in, he railed against the whole thing and against Hellyer and everything. And I thought, boy, this is going to be a happy time. And, of course, because I was staying in their house, I had to spend the evening with them. And so did poor Rothschild. He was able to escape during the day and go and look at his supply depots and technical organizations. But they hammered at us, both Mrs. Landy Moore and the Admiralty. And I came back to Ottawa after that. We accomplished a certain amount. And another thing was Landy Moore took such a dim view of this. His deputy, was it his deputy? Or anyway, there was an Air Force Air Commodore who was on his staff to sort of consolidate. He was the one that did the maritime patrol, you know, the Argus and mm-hmm. whatnot. The Navy had its own fleet air arm in those days. And Shearwater was a naval base, but he wouldn't invite him to the discussions on the organization of maritime command. Because they didn't get on. Well, that was embarrassing. These are tales out of school for sure. Anyway, I went back, and by then the chief of personnel was Vice Admiral Dyer.
Right. Yeah, we've just got a few feet of tape left. We can just keep going on this one.
And I went to Dyer, and I said, look, my friend, there's going to be hell to pay if something doesn't happen, because I said, Landy Moore is really stirring things up, and his attitude makes it impossible to talk to him.
Mm-hmm.
And Dyer shook his head and said, well, I'll do the best I can. Well, as you know, he got fired. I was sorry, because Landy Moore was an extraordinarily capable officer. A fractious little man, but he was a very capable officer, and he had the best interests of the Navy at heart. But there was almost an incident down there, you know, which I would think would have been the worst possible thing that could have happened to the Navy.
Well, maybe we should leave it at that and pick it up on the next time.
Weird interview conducted with former Rear Admiral Charles Dillon on January the 27th, and this is side A of the tape. Admiral Dillon, you were stating with the last tape the firing of Admiral Landy Moore, and you had just come back from an excursion or trip where you were setting up the Maritime Command, and you were just recollecting the rapport that you had had with Admiral Landy Moore and your feelings about his dismissal.
Well, of course, his dismissal came some months after I'd been down there. I think I said earlier that he was a great professional loss to the Navy, because he was a very able seagoing officer. The trouble with Landy Moore, which I was well aware of, is that he got into a personal vendetta with the minister, Paul Hellyer, and he behaved in a manner which I, to this day, believe was wrong. Now, he had various options. He could have resigned. He could have accepted what he was told to do and got on with it,
which is what most people had to do of all the services, because, as I am sure I've said before, we are servants of our political masters, and if we try to take the law into our own hands, it's wrong. And it's not the way we were brought up.
Right.
We, on many occasions, had to do a lot of things that people didn't agree with. Silly things, if you will, at the whim of some government or minister or politician. But it wasn't our job to challenge these people. Now, Landy Moore was fired. He was fired very fairly. He didn't lose his pension or anything like that. He was given every opportunity to salvage what he had contributed to the Navy. I don't mean from a monetary point of view, although that came too. But you could say that he left with honor. But he stirred everybody up to a point where I was afraid that there might be a most unfortunate incident in Halifax.
By unfortunate incident, what would you mean? Some sort of retribution or something?
No, but there could have been a demonstration, a form of rebellion, if you will.
Right.
Because you got everybody all stirred up.
Admiral Landy Moore wasn't the only high-ranking officer within the Navy that left at this time, too, was he?
No. There were others, but they left for a variety of reasons, and they didn't make trouble to the extent that Landy Moore did. Admiral Sterling, who lives here, he told the minister, and he told this to me, that he just couldn't hack it, wasn't prepared to accept the changes that were imminent. And he resigned, and he was given a good break, too. Admiral Welland resigned, and while I'm not totally familiar with his reasons, I think one of the reasons that prompted him was the fact that Admiral Hennessy, or at that time he was Commodore Hennessy, and he was bumped two ranks to Vice Admiral. Now, one of the reasons why some people left, other people stayed, was the people who stayed felt that they had a responsibility to the men and the junior officers, or the officers junior to them, and that it was all very well to bare your chest and beat it and
get out, but you were leaving a lot of people with absolutely no direction and support from the naval side. So everybody didn't quit, and thank goodness they didn't. I think I've already explained that in my case, I was due to retire anyway in 1966, and quite frankly I couldn't see any advantage to the service, certainly not to me, if I didn't complete my term. And I had a strong feeling of responsibility for the people who had been on my team in the Navy and the logistics side, and I felt that it would have been grossly unfair to have pushed off and left them to their own devices. Now, there were a number of military officers, army officers, and some air officers who left. There was Lieutenant General Frank Fleury, who was my boss at that time. There was General Monsell, who started out as a great enthusiast for integration and the sort of amorphous approach we had to unification. But finally, he was a dyed-in-the-wool soldier, and he finally decided to leave. Now, I know it's not totally irrelevant, but one has to bear in mind that some of these people who left
had very considerable private means, and anything they lost on their pension was more than taken care of. Monsell was one. His wife was very wealthy. Andy Moore's wife was very well off. I think she owned a bunch of breweries or something in England. And some of the others, Welland wasn't, but and then there was another one, Birchall.
Yeah, he resigned by mistake one day and changed his mind and came back. And there were others. There were some captains who also chucked their hands in for various reasons. It's a traumatic time for people, and many of them behaved in a very sincere and earnest manner according to their own principles and beliefs. Fortunately, everybody didn't bug out, because the Navy would have been left in a very sad state. Now,
did you yourself and some of the other high-ranking officers within the Navy feel that possibly by resigning that they were making a statement to the federal government that maybe the Navy was getting the short end of the stick compared to the Air Force or the Army at this time? Was that maybe the...
I think we felt that the Navy and the Air Force were getting the short end of the stick, because we lost our title, you know. We ceased being the Royal Canadian Navy. And the substitute was supposed to be the sea element of the Canadian Armed Forces. Well, that's just gobbledygook. The one uniform stuck in the craw of a lot of people, you know, a common uniform. Because, again, the dress of sailors and naval officers is a worldwide maritime custom. I believe the only Navy, and I don't know that they even do it to this day in the world, who wore a single uniform was the Israeli Navy. Now, I've never seen the Israeli Navy, but and I don't know what Mr. Bloody Gaddafi and his Navy wear, but it seems to me that in the news last night, when I saw him going aboard his patrol boat and going out to challenge the Sixth Fleet. Incidentally, this morning's paper says that he suffers from seasickness, so he didn't stay out very long. But I do remember there were some people dressed in naval uniforms, which is encouraging, if you will. But going back to dress, all the navies in the world dress like sailors. And the fact that we were going to dress ours in a common uniform, and it was entirely different than anything anybody else wore as seagoing people, this was very hard to take. And there were other things, the introduction of army ranks into the Navy and calling people privates and corporals and sergeants, that went down badly. The Air Force accepted this better. In fact, a lot of senior Air Force officers were the prime movers in adopting the Army ranks for Air Force officers. One of the reasons for that was because of the very close working with the U.S. Air Force and the
participation in NORAD and etc., that they came to the conclusion that the